Welcome to the Military Child Education Coalition podcast, the show that highlights a wide range of challenges and triumphs that our military-connected kids experience. My name is Nikki Harrison, and I'll be your host today. I am so excited to have joining me today a very special guest, very honored for her to be here with us, and I would love for her to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay, my name is Andrea Motley Crabtree. I'm from Westchester, New York. I joined the Army in 1977. I was in the WAC, and the WAC Corps was still WACs. And then about a year and a half after that, I entered into the regular Army. I have three grown sons. I have a grandchild on the way, and I love to play pickleball.
I like that you added in the part about the pickleball, because I know we were talking the other day and I thought, I am just now getting into pickleball, and I'm a tennis player. You know, that's what I grew up playing, but I'm loving some pickleball.
Well, see, I already don't like you because we don't like the tennis players that come in and, you know, the first week they're all stumbling around and don't know how to play and trying to figure out the score and the lines and everything. Then the next week they're about five readings ahead of us.
you listen, that is exactly what happened. I was like, what is, my mother-in-law actually got me into this. So I was like, okay, we'll see what this pickleball is, but hopefully I will do, you know, with what everything she taught me, I'll kind of put it into action. So, but I just thought that was something fun when you said you like to play pickleball. So this month is Women's History Month, and we are featuring so many incredible women and celebrating them in all of the roles in their lives. And so I, again, really excited and very honored to have you talk about your background. And so I would love for you to tell our listeners if you always wanted to serve.
Yes, I have a family history of service to country. My great maternal grandfather was 12 years old when the slaves were freed. His mother paid $32.50 for his freedom while she was pregnant with him so that he could be born free. And, you know, it's no coincidence that his last name was Freeman. He was a farmer, and he rode for the Pony Express. Now, my maternal grandmother, she worked for the Marine Corps sewing parachutes in Philadelphia. And four of her sons were in the military. My paternal grandfather was a cook in the U.S. Army. And my father spent 23 years in the Army in military police and serving the Secret Service. So there's several aspects of military service that interested me. You know, obviously knowing of and being proud of my family history gave me a desire to be a part of that history and a willingness to serve. The fact that my father had been serving since before my birth and knowing he was not able to be home with us due to his service to country was a huge contributor to my interest in serving. It seemed to me to be a selfless act that he chose service to country over being with his wife and watching his children grow. Everything that I knew about military service, I learned from watching John Wayne and other movies. They gave me a sense of intrigue and adventure. Most of all, it seemed like something I wanted to be a part of. I loved the uniforms and the regimentation of it. My brother had gone to military school somewhat reluctantly, while I would have given anything to go. The idea that 20 years of service would get me health benefits and paid a small pension for the rest of my life was also very, very enticing to me. And I knew that I might not get rich off of it, but I knew I could feed myself and keep a roof over my head. So I took all of these things together when I made my decision to join. Around the age of 11 or 12, I had expressed my interest in serving to several adults that were, you know, available to me for counsel. And however, I was strongly discouraged and told that military service was not for women. So I pretty much put any thoughts of being able to serve just right out of my head. Years later, after high school, I moved to Michigan to get in-state residency to attend Michigan State College. And while I was there, I was offered a walk-on track scholarship. In the process of getting the scholarship and the paperwork done, there was some confusion with the paperwork. And out of frustration, I wasn't even thinking. I went home, I picked up the yellow pages and called the Army recruiter. I never even thought about it. It just happened. I was in such a hurry to get in. I think the recruiters thought that I was running away from something. I might have been a criminal or something. But in any case, in May of 1977, I enlisted into the Women's Army Corps, WAC for short, for training in the military occupational skill of 35 ECHO, which is Special Electrical Electronic Repairment Course. I was sent to Fort McCullen, Alabama, which is the home of the Women's Army Corps for basic training. Women have served in the military for over 200 years, just not always in uniform or as equals to their male counterparts. It was in 1948 that the first enlisted women entered the regular Army. Later that year, the first WAC officers received regular Army appointments. You know, women served as typists, nurses, mail clerks, and other traditional roles in support of the military since the American Revolution. But the Women's Army Corps was a separate corps of the Army. And I think a lot of people don't really realize that. And it wasn't until 1978, so that was about a year after I joined, that the Women's Army Corps was disestablished. And then there was only one army with women and men serving side by side, with the exception of MOSs that were closed to women. There were plenty of MOSs that were closed to women at that time. Pretty much anything that was thought a woman obviously could not do, such as infantry, rangers, Delta Force. Still, there were several MOSs that were closed to women, but had no women in them. Some women had tried to pass some of these MOSs or schools, but had failed. And I guess really no one felt the need to officially close them because, this is just my opinion, because it was thought women either would not be interested in them or would not be able to complete the courses. And I remember talking to people, other soldiers, about this back in the 70s, and people said that the American people were just not ready to see a woman come home in a body bag. Women will never be in a war zone. You know, women aren't strong enough to do the work men can. If men and women work together on the battlefield, the men wouldn't be able to concentrate, and all the women would end up pregnant. You know, I can remember living through this and hearing people, you know, say these things. So for me, a year and a half into my enlistment, it was a whole new world of military history. And not just for me, but for everyone, for all the men, all the women that were put together. And there weren't any training manuals to go by. Women were just thrown in with the men, and everyone had to figure out how to make it work. I had attended Advanced Individual Training, or AIT, at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after completion of the 35 ECHO course, a few of us were selected for hometown recruiting. I was sent to Hawaii. I requested to go to YTT Hawaii, and I got it, even though I'm not from Hawaii. And when I reported for duty at the recruiting headquarters, the command sergeant major told me, I don't know where you came from, how you got here, but you need to go back the same way. He questioned my reason for being there. He asked me if I was from Hawaii, if I had had any family there, if I knew anyone from there, or even if, you know, I had ever been to Hawaii before. And I answered no to all of his questions. And he said, you know, you can't do anything for me here. And I said, Sergeant Major, you know, please give me a minute to convince you to let me stay. Sergeant Major, once I go into the high schools and tell the students, hey, I'm from New York, and I joined the Army for fun, travel, and adventure, and to travel the world. And look where I am today, in YTC, Hawaii. And he thought a moment, and he said, okay, you can stay. So I thought that was great, and I stayed, and I had a great time.
I mean, what a journey. The Women's Army Corps, which I think so many of us were not aware of, and just the battles that you had being a woman, you know, gaining entry into some of the MOSs. You know, I've told the listeners before that my husband is a Marine. And so it wasn't until just recently that the Marine Corps allowed women into ground combat operations. It's interesting to watch how the military has evolved over time and allowing women access into jobs that maybe they never would have had the opportunity. And then I also wanted to highlight the fact that you have an incredible familial history when it comes to the military and service. And so it's almost like it was really part of your path kind of to serve. There's, you know, so much there and what you said, but just really a journey that you've been on. And it's incredible that you were the first Black female deep sea diver in any of the military branches and the first female deep sea diver in the U.S. Army. A deep sea diver, I would think, would be a really strong swimmer. And so I just love to know how you got into diving.
The way I got into Army diving, I was in Waikiki on that hometown recruiting duty that wasn't my hometown. And the hotel that I was staying at, I saw a flyer on the wall, and it was offering a scuba diving trip for $50. This would have been in 1978. So I called the number listed, and a van picked me up. The water was warm. The visibility was like 90 feet. There were tropical fish everywhere. It was the most beautiful thing I had ever experienced in my life. A few years later, I was stationed in Nuremberg, Germany. And as I was walking across the quad, I was stopped by the battalion reenlistment in CLIC. He told me that my enlistment was almost up and asked what I wanted to reenlist for. And I said, I don't know. What are my choices? And he said, you could reenlist for station of choice or for a school to change your MOS. Then he said, why don't you reenlist for deep sea diver? I don't think the Army has any women divers yet. And my mind went straight to my memories of diving in Hawaii. And I said, the Army will pay me to be a diver? And he said, the only thing is, before you can apply, you have to be scuba certified. I said, oh my God, what am I going to do? So I decided I want to be an Army diver. And I needed a path to get there. I had to figure out how to get where I wanted to be and the steps I needed to take to get there. The first thing I needed was to get scuba certified, obviously. To get certified, I wanted to be someplace warm and near the ocean. So I decided to reenlist for Fort Ord, California, one of my reenlistment options. California seemed to be the perfect place to take diving lessons. Once I got there, I needed to be able to have my days free so that I could dive as much as possible and take the lessons. I explained my goals to my first sergeant and asked for his help. And I was assigned as NCOIC of one of the post gymnasiums. I had a couple of squads of soldiers to help me run the gym. And I taught them my standard for maintaining the gym and told them the consequences of not keeping it to my standards. And that worked out well for me. It wasn't long before I received my certification. I went through the Aquarius Dive Shop in Monterey, California, and I dove every chance I got. So with certification in hand, I started filling out my requests for dive school. That was the beginning of it.
Yeah, I really like that it was that duty station of Hawaii that kind of sparked that love for the diving when you had that opportunity. It just reminds me when we're talking with, especially our military connected kids, we talk a lot about, you know, resiliency and trying different things out. You know, you move one place, it could be a completely different place than where you were before. It's an adventure. You know, maybe there'll be something you're interested in or becomes a hobby. And so I find it really interesting that that's how that part of your career started, was through a duty station at Hawaii and the diving. And I will also say, as someone who's lived in California, I think it's absolutely beautiful. And I'm not a diver, as I think I admitted to you that I can't swim. But
you don't need to know how to swim to dive.
You said that. You said I don't need to know how to swim. But your description of what it felt like, it makes me want to try it out myself. Actually, that's what I was thinking. So you change your MOS, you're certified, and starting that process, you know, what does that look like for a deep sea diver? Because I would imagine it's probably pretty complex.
At this point, I am certified as a civilian scuba diver. Now that I've got my civilian certification, I'm doing the process to get the application into the school to get orders to go to school to try to become a deep sea diver. I have no idea what the process is today, but I can tell you what it was back in 1980. So in 1980, to get into dive school, you needed to have what was called a Class A flight physical with every single block on the form filled out. The hardest thing to complete to become a diver is getting the paperwork done and getting in and getting orders to dive school. Now, it took me about 6 months after I had my scuba certification to get this done. Every time I went for a physical, I was told that I had enough information to apply by the doctors, but then I would wait weeks to hear back from specialized training branch in Alexandria, Virginia at the Hoffman Building as to whether I'd been accepted for training or not, only to have my dive packet sent back because my flight physical was incomplete. So then I'd have to go back to the doctors and say, this isn't complete. I need every single block filled out. And it was like they were angry that they had to fill out every block. But, you know, I was an E5 at the time, and I wasn't going to argue with doctor's officers and stuff like that. So they would fill out something. I would send it back. Of course, by this time, I had found the telephone number and made a contact at the specialized training branch, Mrs. Scott. When she got my packet, I would call her. She said, yeah, I got your packet. You still need blocks, da-da-da-da-da, and da-da-da, filled out. And I would go back, and I'd say, I need these blocks done. And it was over and over again. So, you know, time was going by, and I was spinning my wheels. And at the rate it was taking me to get the application completed, you know, I didn't think I was ever going to get to dive school. But by using FedEx Overnight and the phone calls to Mrs. Scott, it took about 6 months, but I finally got my packet approved and I got orders for dive school. And one thing I want to say about Mrs. Scott and my first sergeant and the recruiter, you know, it's like there are times when people come into your life and instead of taking a right, you might take a left or you might go forward. And I think especially young people need to be on the lookout. When people are extending an olive branch and or trying to help, you need to be able to take advice or at least think about the realm of possibility and don't put anything beyond the realm of possibility. I can look back now. I didn't realize it all at the time, but there were a lot of people that helped me. My life would have gone in a different direction if they hadn't been a part of my life and did the things that they did, especially with diving, especially my entire military career.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head because I always think it just takes one person to, you know, give you a piece of advice or to show you something a little bit different perspective-wise than what you think, or sometimes it could take multiples. It's really hard for a lot of us. We think we have a plan. We're heading down the path on that plan. Maybe you're, you know, putting things in place to accomplish it. And then all of a sudden, you know, a door is closed and then realizing, well, actually the door that was for you or what was meant for you was actually really over here. And, you know, when you were talking, I was like, yes, yes, yes. I think all of that is really so important, especially like you said, for our young people today. So, you know, now you're at the process where we're able to get certified as a civilian. You're able to get your paperwork done to go to the school for dive school. You know, I'd love to know what your thoughts were when you were on your way to that Navy deep sea diving and salvage training school.
So I'm still having visions of diving in Hawaii in my head with the warm water, all the beautiful tropical fish. I thought basic training would have been the hardest thing I would ever endure in the military. I didn't think there was anything harder than basic training. And I had had fun in basic training. It felt like summer camp to me. That's what I was expecting. You know, beautiful clear water, tropical fish, and maybe getting pushed as hard as basic training. Now, I knew I was a woman attending a predominantly male course. I knew I was a soldier attending a predominantly sailor school. And I knew I was Black attending a predominantly white environment. What I found out was that I was attending a very intense, physically and mentally challenging course that in no way resembled the thoughts in my head of diving in Hawaii. I also found out that being a Black Army woman neither helped nor hindered me. What did help me was the civilian training, the confidence and physical fitness I received qualifying as a scuba diver, and the many dives I took as a certified diver in California, and the assistance I received from Mr. Scott. I found out later that I did not need to be a certified diver to attend dive school. And, you know, right there, I think the benefit of going to California and getting civilian certified, the confidence and everything that it gave me, building up muscle mass and all that, it could have been a completely different story once I got to dive school if I hadn't gone through that. So I'm grateful. I feel blessed that I had that experience. Even though it was some erroneous information, it turned out to be something that helped me. There's been many situations and people that led me down the path to reaching my goal of becoming an Army diver. I consider each of them, as well as, you know, like I said, this erroneous information, a blessing. And I don't believe that I would have been there without that. And I just can't stress enough what a completely different outcome it could have been. So now I'm at the school and it's the first day of diver pre-qualification. On that first day, you got to qualify to attend the course. You don't just get there and start class. You have to pass a series of tests. And if you pass them all, then you start the course. My class started with about 32 applicants. There were 8 soldiers, a couple of guardsmen, maybe a Marine or two, and the rest were sailors. I was the only woman in my class and the only Black. It was obvious to me that some of the men did not want me there. Comments were made, such as I should be home in the kitchen barefoot and pregnant. Some of the men just ignored me. But a few had no problem with me being there, and we got along well. We needed to pass a 1.5-mile run, some push-ups, sit-ups, and swim tests, pressure and oxygen tolerance tests, and we had to try to do 6 pull-ups. We also needed to show the ability to wear the Mark V deep-sea diving rig by rising from a seated position, go down a ladder into the water, and then climb back out unassisted. The Mark V weighs close to 200 pounds. The helmet and the breastplate weigh 64 pounds. The shoes weigh 17.5 pounds each. The weight belt weighs 83 pounds. And then there's leather and leaded, and the dress, the white, which you see that looks like some people might call it a suit, but we call it a dress. So the leather and the lead and the dress weigh about another 25 pounds. And because the dress is not waterproof, diver can expect to get about 75 pounds of water inside. So you take the weight of the person, the almost 200 pounds of the rig, and maybe 75 pounds of water in that. And that's what you have to climb back up the ladder wearing. That Mark V took out a lot of prospective divers, not just women, but it took out a good number of men. We had to pass all the tests except for the sit-ups, which we needed to pass by the end of the course to graduate. If a candidate passed most of the tests and was close to passing other tests, they were sometimes given the opportunity to train and given a chance to be retested. Some people were just not fit enough to complete the testing, and some just said it wasn't what they thought it would be and quit. I passed all of my required tests except the swim test, and I was given 2 weeks to better my time. When I took the test again in 2 weeks, I had greatly improved my time, but it just wasn't enough to pass. I knew sooner or later, probably sooner than later, that someone would be telling me I had failed out of the course and I would be reassigned for the needs of the Army. I had no clue as to what to do, but I still wanted to be an Army diver. Then out of nowhere, a Navy chief came up to me and said, "Hey, listen, if this is something you really want to do, you need to disenroll yourself, go learn how to swim, and reapply." He said, "If you fail again, you will be disqualified and not be able to reapply." So here I am. I've got a new path. I disenrolled myself, and I was assigned to an Army diving detachment at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. The divers in the unit were, for the most part, very welcoming, and I practiced swimming every day. And once I got to where I thought I could pass my test, the divers there gave me a test, and I passed it. I reapplied for school, when I got back to school, I passed my swim test with flying colors, and we would run through muddy water, cover ourselves with it, and we'd run some more to the white sandy beach and rub sand into the mud, which we called either sugar cookies, and then we, if we were lucky, we would run into the water, which they called cream rinse, and then do, you know, some push-ups while we tried to wash the mud and sand off of our bodies before we started running a little bit more. Sand has a tendency to chafe. Otherwise, we just run back to school and do more push-ups, flutter kicks, hello darlings, and 8-count bodybuilders. The amount of mental and physical training is daunting, and the emotions that arose in me to be able to not only endure but thrive was like a drug in my body. I couldn't get enough of it. The more I exercised, the stronger I got. The stronger I got, the more I wanted it. You know, to be pushed to the limits that were set to complete the course is something that is just, I just loved it. I loved it. I wish I could go back, be young, and go through it again. But in any case, I graduated in April of 1982.
I mean, again, such incredible story. And I was listening to your descriptors talking about the feeling and really the persistence that you had to go and better learn how to swim so that you could go back to the course. Like, I just think there's so much there, and that really it was not just a calling. It's like who you were to be a deep sea diver. And so I can only hope that we all find something so passionate about in our lives to pursue and have a purpose for. So you were able to get through the training. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened after you returned to Fort Belvoir as a second class deep sea diver?
You know, a Florida newspaper did an article on me for graduating as the first U.S. Army female deep sea diver. I was misquoted, and the comment angered the Army divers, especially the ones at my new unit. And the attitude of the men had changed. When I asked why, they told me that they didn't think I'd make it. Bottom line was they did not want women in the Army, not in the Army diving, not just me, but they didn't want any woman in the Army diving. I was a good diver, and divers in positions of power knew it. They knew it before I knew. And they knew if I continued to excel as a diver, there was a good chance that I would make master diver, and they were not going to let that happen. Due to Army policy changes, 23 MOSs were closed to women. And, you know, 00 Bravo, my MOS deep sea diver, was one of the 23. So my career as a diver was just abruptly halted, and I went back to my old MOS.
Wow. You know, it just goes to show, you know, I started with when we were talking about Women's History Month and us celebrating and highlighting how far we've come as women in this country in so many roles, you know, from not just being the stay-at-home mom with the barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen, which was unfortunately, for a lot of men, that's where they thought that, you know, women's roles were. And so for you to have something that you were so passionate about and you loved so much, it just really, you know, feels heartbreaking for that to have happened. And yeah, I was thinking as you were talking about, even though some of the challenges and the hardships that you went through, you know, would you go back and do it all over again?
In a heartbeat. Obviously, there are things that I would do differently. And I believe that some of those things would have allowed me to stay in Army diving. I mean, I just loved it. I don't know. It's hard to think about sometimes. It's had an effect on my life mentally. There are things that, you know, I just can't get over. If I was a bad diver, if I had failed dive school, failed my swim test, failed any part of it, I could accept that. That would admit that I wasn't good enough and I didn't deserve to wear that diver badge. And I could have lived with that. But to go through what I went through, earn that badge, not only earn it, but be good at it and better than most of the men that I dove with, but to be run out, not because I wasn't a good diver, but because I'm a woman, I have a big problem getting over that. But to answer your question, yes, I would do it all over again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I suspected that that's what you would say. And, you know, I think everything that you went through has, I hope you feel like, led to, you know, providing opportunities and doors for women now, especially in the military, and that you have a legacy that you've left in your service. And so I want to say thank you for being so vulnerable in discussing your service. And it really is incredible, the journey that you've had, the calling, the, I think, is really probably who you are to this day. And I would love to know if you have any advice for women in military service, maybe young women thinking about military service, or those that are serving right now.
You know, when I spoke about the path and how to get to that path, being able to be conscious, that's very important. You have to be conscious that you need a plan, and you need to consciously think about and ask yourself, what is that plan? I call it the path. And the way I use that is I say, okay, this is where I want to be. This is my goal. Where am I now? I'm here. Okay, what obstacles do I need to overcome to get to my goal? So I start at where I am in that process and go forward. Now, if you got to go 10 steps and you get 3 steps and something happens, you don't just quit. If it's still something you want to do, you have to figure out a way to get around, get through to accomplish that step, and then go on to the next one. There's a couple of things that happened to me while I was a diver that I use still today. One of them is, you know, the body can do 5 times what the brain thinks it can do. So even if you're as tired as you think you are, your body could probably do more. So don't quit at the first sign of stress or discomfort. Another thing I'd like to tell you about a situation that happened while I was at dive school, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. We were in the Mark V, the deep sea dive rig, and there's a thing called a tucker patch that we have to take apart underwater. We have to tie the gasket to a line, give line pull signals as if there's no communication. We give line pull signals to the people up topside. We have to give the correct line pull signal. They pull it up. They see the gasket is there. And then we have to give line pull signals to get the gasket back down, and we put the tucker patch back together, and it needs to hold water. When I was doing my patch, I was sitting on the bottom, and I didn't say it before, but the Mark V dress has 3 finger gloves. Try to imagine that. So it's really hard to turn bolts and adjust and move things. So I set my gasket up, gotten it back, and I had put the patch back together, but I didn't think I had it done right. And I was sitting on the bottom, and I know my eyes were welling up. I was thinking to myself, maybe those guys are right. Maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe I should be home barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. All these things were going on in my head. And, you know, topside's like, red diver, topside, are you finished? You know, give your line pull signals. And I was just sitting there thinking. And I just sat there for a while, and I made up my mind. I said, I can't do this. And when I got back up topside, I got undressed, and I was walking to the training office to disenroll myself. And I ran into a Navy chief, Chief Smith, and he said, hey, Motley, how you doing? And, you know, he goes, well, where are you going? What are you doing? I said, I'm going to disenroll myself. I can't do this. I've had enough. And he said, wait a minute. What day is it? I don't know. Wednesday. Leave me alone. Go away. And he says, well, what time is it? 2:30. Why are you asking me these questions? And he says, look, do this. Finish out the day. Finish out the week. Go out and party Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Have a good time. Drink some beer. Eat some oysters. Monday morning, when you wake up, if you no longer want to be here, put on your Class A's, go to the training office, and disenroll. You wake up Monday morning and you do want to be here. Put on your PT gear, get your ass out the PT. So I turned around and I went back to the dive station. And guess what? My Tooker patch was perfect. It's just another one of those instances, and I'm kind of getting a little emotional, but it's just one of those times when people can be the change in your life, and you have to be willing to allow them in, and you have to be able to recognize them, and you have to learn from it and keep it, and I believe you have to pass it on to others. That's what I like the young people to know and understand.
Yeah, I was getting a little teary-eyed there too towards the end. But yes, it goes back to it just taking one person or even a series of people that can lift you up, can bring you along and just really give you some great advice and just be a support system for you. And sometimes even when you don't realize that you need it, I think we talk a lot about how sometimes we think we're good on our own, we can do it all, and there's a lot of times we can't do it all and we need someone to help. And sometimes that person ends up being an unexpected, you know, person that comes into your life. A really great story, and I think some really good advice for our young people here in the world. So I just want to say thank you so much again. Really honored to have you here. And thank you for your service, dedication, and everything that you have done along the way to open doors for so many that you may not even realize that you opened. So thank you.
You're welcome. And I would like to thank your husband for his service. And you can tell him that I really wanted to go in the Marines, but because of my family history of service the country through the Army, I felt I had to go in the Army.
Okay. I'll let him know that. Well, thank you again. I think just so honored. So thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. I'd like to thank Andrea for her time today, as I've really enjoyed our conversation. And it's been an honor to hear about her incredible journey of military service. We hope you've enjoyed our Women's History Month podcast series in celebration of accomplishments women have had. Thanks for listening to the MSEC podcast, the official podcast of the Military Child Education Coalition. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, and give today's show a 5-star rating. And don't forget to leave us a comment on topics you'd like to hear more about. And we'd like to give a special thanks to Consensus Media for audio mixing. I'm Nikki Harrison, and until next time, in a world where you can be anything, be kind.